everybody to... Wait a minute. Did you hear that, Barry? Did you hear that? Barry, did you hear it?
Well, what?
That was the explosive beginning. You see what I did there?
Oh, I see what
episode
you did.
Episode of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. Yeah, see, everyone was wondering, who's going to be the one to make the explosive joke? And the explosion, I did not watch last night, but from what I understand, the explosion was slightly less impactful than the one you had after a night of Ethiopian food.
Oh boy.
The proverbial fart in a church, if you will. Mr. Rose, welcome to episode 179, sir.
Well, I appreciate that. And so are you trying to steal Joe Christie's thunder with the Ethiopian shit references?
Who?
Exactly. The killer.
Ask me about Joe Christie. Go ahead, Barry. Ask me.
Yeah. What about Joe Christie?
You know, the last person we did that to, I think he legitimately got pissed off at me. So anyway.
I think he did get pissed off. You're right.
It was all a rib, my friend. It was all a rib. Okay, here on episode 179, we're going to have part two of our really fun interview with Kevin Kelly, the voice of New Japan and New Japan World and former WWE announcer and overall good guy and official friend of the show, definitely, Barry. Besides that, unfortunately, we have some sad news we're going to discuss. We're going to talk about the recent losses to the wrestling community of Jim Crockett Jr. and Buddy Colt. We'll be talking about that. Maybe we're going to do a little F, marry, or kill. Maybe, if you're good. I'm going to offer Barry Rose a last meal choice that I think will be a difficult one for him. So, and we're going to discuss our movie tournament. By the way, did you see the latest poll that dropped right as we started recording, Mr. Rose?
One of your favorites. Was this son-in-law?
No. That was the 2 o'clock. What was the 3 o'clock?
I don't have any idea. What was the 3 o'clock?
Kingpin.
Oh, I did see it. Kingpin versus something I didn't give a shit about. Right, I think.
Ruthless people. That's now, see, this is an example. I'll be honest. I'm gonna break kayfabe. I'll break kayfabe right friggin' now. 2 o'clock vote. Son-in-law, Happy Gilmore, didn't like either movie. Boom! I'm going to put that out there. Not a fan of Pauly Shore. Only like a few select movies of Adam
Sandler.
Thank you. I like a few of Adam Sandler's movies. That was not one that I liked. But on the other hand, the 3 o'clock vote, Kingpin, big Ern McCracken, of course, and Ruthless People, I fucking love that movie. Danny DeVito is hilarious, and it's a movie that, quite frankly, not a lot of people saw. It's a very, very funny movie. Did you ever see it?
I have. Absolutely. I've seen it. Okay, 1986. Like, yeah.
You're poo-pooing it? Is that what you're saying? Or just compared to Kingpin?
I think just compared to Kingpin. Ruthless People is good. There's a great line, which I have used multiple times from that movie. When a telemarketer calls and asks for somebody, I say, she can't come to the phone because my cock is in her throat. So when that Danny DeVito does funny, that. Yes.
Yeah. And of course, the line that most people remember from that movie is a Bette Midler line when she finds out that her husband has been refusing to pay the ransom from the kidnappers. And so they said, well, we started at 100,000. Oh, that should be no problem. He said, no. Well, what happened then? Oh, well, we told him we'd accept 50,000. Yeah. What'd he say then? He said, no. So now we're down to 10,000. She goes, wait a minute. Am I understanding this right? I'm being kidnapped by Kmart. So, yeah, that's a pretty funny line.
Ruthless People, too, is this Judge Reinhold and Helen Slater?
Yes. Wow. Very fine-looking Helen Slater, I might add.
Beautiful, so, beautiful woman. Yeah.
Good. So anyway, I tell you what, Barry, before we get into all the Michigas of our first time we've said Michigas in a while, of our show, let's talk a little bit about the public reaction, since I did not watch the pay-per-view last night. The public reaction to the AEW pay-per-view. Barry, did you in fact watch it?
I did not. So one of our group members, Brian, told me, if you want a link, I'd be more than happy to get you a link to see it. Told me that that he would have it for me today, the day after. And after reading all the reviews, Jeff, I'm going to refuse the link.
Yeah, my understanding was there was a great deal of disappointment about the show. That is all. And then, of course, the explosive match, which and quite frankly, I thought was a really bad idea to begin with. I mean, Omega and Moxley are very capable of having an excellent match. OK, why you want to put these two, let's just go say it, maybe the two best wrestlers they have in the promotion in a gimmick match like that is kind of absurd, to be honest with you, you know?
I still don't get it, Jeff. I as we sit here, and I know we've talked about this in the past, and look, your nickname is the Booker, and you've certainly you've done some fantasy booking and stuff, but even as a longtime wrestling
fan... Hold on, Barry. Hold on 1 second. Phone call. No, Tony, I can't talk right now. Get back to me about an hour after we're done recording, and I'll consider the offer. I'm sorry, that was Tony Khan on the phone, Barry.
Well, and Jeff, even though you've never worked within the confines of professional wrestling and actually drawn a paycheck, I have full confidence that you could be booking AEW right now and be doing a better job, without a doubt, because I just don't understand. And to your point that you just said, Jeff, you're 100% correct. Why would you take Kenny Omega, look like Kenny Omega, hate Kenny Omega, putting fireworks and shit like that's not going to make his matches any better. Moxley doesn't need it. You have two guys that could go out there and have a really stellar match. Instead, you want to put all this gimmick shit around it, which makes no sense. It's mind boggling.
Yeah, nah, not a well thought out idea. You know, that's the kind of thing, quite frankly. And I'm not going to mean to put the boots to the guy, okay, because I happen to like Jericho. But that's the kind of thing Jericho at his age, now that he's more physically limited than he was, say, 10 or 15 years ago when he was absolutely exceptional. But now, you know, that's why Terry Funk was doing those kind of matches. Right. God bless him. You know, in 1993, after he'd had his run with All Japan, this is not a kind of match that somebody at their level, the two guys. You know, because Moxley just won, I just noticed, Wrestler of the Year in the Observer Awards. And Omega, again, like him or love him, the guy, when it, you know, he can have a really good match when he's in there. And I know the jazz hands and all that other crap that people complain about. He can have a good match. And he and Moxley could have a really strong match with one another. And that's why I was kind of disappointed. And then from what I understand, the actual construction of the match was left lacking, let's just say. So, and as Lou, could you join us momentarily, my man?
Sweet Lou on the bathroom break, Jeff. So
okay,
yeah. Hold on, I'm zipping up.
Oh no, Lou's done. Yeah. He's all done right. With the Ethiopian food.
I had
Lou,
to tie it in a knot. Yeah.
Thank you. What was the quote you gave me before we started recording about overselling the gimmick or the underselling the gimmick? The arrival. Right. What was that expression you used?
Yeah, it's something I heard years ago in the business world, and I apologize because I forget who posted it. On one of the Facebook groups, it said, you know, always strive to under-promise and over-deliver.
Thank you. And thank you, Lou. I appreciate it. And what they did was the exact opposite of that. You know, they over-promised and under-delivered. And that was the disappointing part of the pay-per-view. Again, this is based on every review that I've read online, not just in our group, but on Twitter and different Facebook groups. You know, this was not like, you know, dare I say, Barry, the mothership, where everybody in the mothership seems to hate AEW. You know, we have people in our group that some people like AEW, some people don't like it. And, you know, you usually get a kind of a fairly balanced opinion on the thing. And the pretty balanced opinion seemed to be that they oversold and underperformed, shall I say.
Yeah, which is the standard, too. And I'll never understand the full hate of AEW. I get that there's stuff in there that's cringeworthy. By the same token, the people that'll praise certain aspects of the WWE completely trash AEW. That's where I'm all confused, because you say what you want. AEW is still light years above whatever the WWE is doing, though in theory, the WWE has actually gotten better over the last few weeks. But, you know, just to go off of what Sweet Lou says and to back him up too, that is an old business saying, because my company, we've had to say that for years to potential clients. Professional wrestling has got a long sordid history of over-promising and under-delivering. And I think Dixie Carter was probably the poster child for that, because every other week, huge announcement, earth-shattering, wrestling will never be the same. Tune into Impact and you tune in and it's this fucking dud. There's nothing there. So, you know, what I get from AEW, and look, nobody wants AEW to succeed from a fan aspect as much as I do. I want to see these guys do well, but a lot of these mistakes that are being made are almost rookie-like mistakes. And yes, I realize they're a new company, yada, yada, yada. But at the same point, Cody Rhodes has been around professional wrestling his entire life. I don't know how old he is. Is he 30? Is he 35? The guy was born into it. He knows professional wrestling. Chris Jericho, has been wrestling now for 30-something years. Again, this guy's been around forever. You don't have a bunch of new people. Your producers in the back, Dean Malenko, Jerry Lynn, guys with long, really solid credentials. Why are all these fucking mistakes happening? Why is this happening? It makes no sense to me.
Well, and using your Dixie Carter reference, you know, the whole bit leading up to the show was the announcement that Paul White had made last Wednesday. Oh, there's going to be a borderline Hall of Fame guy that's going to show up at the pay-per-view. And I'm watching and, you know, watching the speculation on, again, all the different Facebook groups, the Twitter feeds. And I literally saw everyone from Ric Flair to Kazuchika Okada to Scott Steiner to Kurt Angle, everybody. And then it was Christian.
Yeah.
And when I found out, I was kind of like, it was Christian. You know, that was kind of my response. You know, it wasn't like, holy shit, Brock Lesnar walked through the door. That's a fucking coup.
That would have been a major coup. Yes.
No, instead it was, it's Christian. You know, I'm not shitting on Christian. Guy's a fine worker, a great talent, but let's be honest. Name recognition wise, it's Christian.
Yeah. And how old is he, Jeff? At this point, too, we're getting a guy that is, you know, I would say he's at the tail end of his career, but for the most part, he's had one match in like 7 or 8 years, I think, right? So he's essentially been retired. And now you're bringing in Christian. I just don't get it. When, again, if you had had Okada, that would have been a big fucking deal. CM Punk was another name that was bandied about. Yes, I do, yeah. Absolutely would have been a huge deal. Brock Lesnar would have been a game changer. But let me ask you this. Is this when Tony Khan signs a guy like Christian Cage, is it what's his mindset? What's his rationale? What's his thinking? Is he going, I'm going to sign Christian Cage and now watch buy rates of our future pay-per-views go up or merchandise go up? Or is he saying, I'm going to sign Christian Cage and watch Vince get really pissed that I did it?
Absolutely. A fair question. I'm concerned that I've said this before, perception is reality in the wrestling business and the way that you are perceived by the casual wrestling fan. And I would be worried if I worked for AEW that the perception is becoming, that's where all the old WWF guys go.
Yep.
You know, and instead of creating new stars, people that you've developed, Sammy Guevara.
Yes, go but ahead. Hold on. You, Jeff, second time in the first 5 minutes of the show, you're 100% correct.
Check.
They've got the talent there. Sammy
Guevara. Of course they do. Eddie Kingston. He's been. Yes.
Phoenix is like the best thing going. And instead. Absolutely. Right.
And it's like 3-7 or something like that.
Exactly. Right. It's
fucking ridiculous, you know. But here again, I talked before about Eddie Kingston, a guy that I, you know, when he first had his first huge promo, I went, wow, where the frick has this guy been for the last 15 years? And, you know, he's working independence. He's working some, you know, the other shows that quite frankly, I don't really watch that much of. And I'm sitting there thinking, this is the guy that you could break out nationally just from his mouth. You know, put a guy like that, you know, in the announcing booth, and he could talk himself up. Let's talk about the way that Roddy Piper became a national heel when they stuck him next to Gordon Soley on Georgia Championship Wrestling. You know, Jesse Ventura became a national act, not because of what he did in the ring, but because they put him with Monsoon and McMahon, and he lit up the ratings because he was so friggin' brilliant as an announcer. And a guy like Eddie Kingston has a personality like that. Jericho, you know, Jericho's what? Is he close to 50 now? That's a guy that should be behind the microphone, not going out there working every week and showing everyone how he started to slide down the mountain of work rate and in-ring ability. But he's still got a brilliant mind for the business. He still could talk his ass off. And that's what these guys should be doing and creating stars out of these guys. Instead, you're putting retreads on the old fucking tire that's got 40,000 miles on it with guys like Christian and, you know, all these other. And I'm sorry, I couldn't help but read last week how everyone seemingly got a huge fucking erection because, the Four Horsemen sign got flashed. That was fucking 35 years ago. Good Lord, people. Do we really need to have a fucking rehash of the Horsemen? I know that's not going to be a real popular opinion, But I'm like, come on, really? Tully Blanchard's in his 60s. It was nice to see him out there wrestling. But do you really want to see Tully Blanchard become a regular in-ring performer? The sad thing is, he's probably still better than some of the guys they got. Exactly. But he's fucking 60. So is Sting. They're pushing Sting as their main event guy. And he's like over 60 years old. And it's crazy, Barry.
It is crazy, too. And I did hear, and I read some of the reports, but that during the Sting match last night, that there was another, I guess, a stuntman Sting, that at times would be he was thinner than the other Sting. So I don't know if
this that is hilarious. I did not hear that story.
Yeah, so
if that's true, that's fucking hilarious.
I don't know all the details, but
stuntman Sting.
Yeah, I guess it was a little cinematic, and they had a second Sting to take bumps and stuff. If you remember too, when Sting had his matches, he had that match, that infamous match against Seth Rollins, where he basically collapsed in ring. And they made this, it was a pay-per-view, so they made a horrific judgment to let the match continue. But here was a guy that was clearly had been knocked out and couldn't stand any longer. And Sting shouldn't be in a ring either. Sting is, what, 60 years old at this point?
Well, you know, what they could do is they could get Barry Windham, have him, like, cut his hair real short.
Sure. That's a great idea.
It worked once before.
Yeah. Jeff Farmer, the imposter Sting, you could get him too. But to your point, so you've got, look, and again, I agree. Look, Tully Blanchard, I didn't see it, but Tully Blanchard, a one-time deal, it's beautiful, it's great. But, you know, Sting has been on, I think, every week, and I don't know if there are plans for Sting going forward. But at the same time, you've got the fucking talent. If you think that you are going to utilize guys like Sting and Christian Cage or the Big Show, the Big Show's another one. I mean, you know, there's not a whole lot there that's left. If you think you're going to utilize these guys to build your promotion, this is the recipe for failure. And take that from a mark, which is what I am at the end of the day. It's ridiculous. You need to build your new talent for the future. If you want to think 2 and 3 years ahead, then you need to start doing that. Otherwise, continue to push Christian Cage, Tully Blanchard, Big Show, Sting, and anybody else that's over 50. It's just absolutely ridiculous, in my opinion.
You know, the thing is from a financial point of view, I don't know that they can do any damage to the WWE because they've got all these contracts with Fox and with all these other streaming services. But strictly from a creative point of view, there are so many different ways that you can go about becoming the go-to product on television, you know, and it's guys like Sammy Guevara. It's guys like MJF, the young guys that don't have, dare I say, the WWE taint to them, that they don't have the stigma. Maybe that's a better word than taint.
Taint. Stick with taint. That was just made my day. That so
then, you know, these guys that, you know, like, no offense, like a Christian or somebody like that, that, oh yeah, I remember that guy when he's with the WWF, you know, they've got some great tag teams that haven't broke out nationally. And you were absolutely right, Barry. Freaking Rey Fénix is the best wrestler on the planet maybe right now.
Yes, he's unbelievable.
And why they aren't pushing this guy as the, good God, give him a junior heavyweight title or something like that and have him go out every week and have great matches against guys like Sammy Guevara or some of the other, you know, guys that are capable of having those kind of matches. And, you know, I have to say, I like the way that they're doing some things. Okay. The slow build on Jungle Boy is a good thing. Having him with Marco Stunt, nah, I'm not a huge fan of that at all. But, you know, there are things and that they're doing that are okay. There are guys there that they're absolutely capable of taking, giving them the ball and having them run with it and creating new stars that aren't old WWE stars. And the fact they're not doing that is very frustrating. And, you know, I get it. Not everybody is going to be, you know, the same thing. Kenny Omega and MJF, they're not going to be doing the same shit that we loved in 1986. I hate to break that to some of you people. You know, it's like the business has evolved, and I would love for it to go back and be 1986.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and things were still the same, and we never had the fucking stigma of Kevin Nash. That was for you, Zaha, and other things like that. But, you know, it's not. The business has changed. There's more quote unquote flippy shit. I'll tell you a funny story, Barry. You know, I was watching, and it was a Bobby Eaton match. It was one of the ones that we were considering having as one of our three candidates for the match of the week. And Bobby Eaton, I don't even remember if he was wrestling like, I don't know, Terry Taylor or so, but you know what it was? It was a match from World, when they first got to World Class. And I watched Bobby Eaton lock up collar and elbow with somebody. And I went, holy shit. Barry, the way he friggin' locked up collar and elbow, you don't see guys do that anymore. I mean, he was angry and aggressive when he locked up, you know? And when he did it, I was like, fuck yeah, man. That's the way you're supposed to do it. And they don't do that anymore. I wish they did, but they don't. And unfortunately, I don't see us going back to that. What do you think?
No, we'll never go back to it. But look, to that point, too, everything evolves to some degree. Even professional football, Jeff, you're a huge football fan. There have been rule changes. Basketball, we've seen rule changes. Everything does change and everything evolves. And unfortunately, it's not always for the better. The way we saw professional wrestling will never come back. There is just, first off, there's a million reasons for it, which we don't have enough time, but with kayfabe being broken the way that it was broken some 30-something years ago at this point, we'll never see professional wrestling the way that we know it. And I think I said this last week, maybe the week before, but once WWE started doing matches where, because there's no live audience, that they can do all these creative edits to, but still present it as it's actually happening live, supposedly happening live, that really is the end of professional wrestling when you stop and think of it. At that point, these are mini type of movies is what's happening. In Japan, there's still professional wrestling, but we're just never going to get back to what we used to love. And, you know, every generation's got what they love, because people now that are watching that are 14 years old are going to be telling their grandkids in 50 years how wonderful Christian Cage was in AEW. As we're sitting here shitting all over it, you know that'll happen. But yeah, it's, to me, wrestling for the most part in this country, I think it stopped in the 1980s. I think at some point, there it is. Who's that, Gunny?
Gunny, you want to be part of the show. You know,
Gunny agreed.
He said 87, but I think 86 is about right. You know?
Yeah, but so for me, a lot of it, honestly, there was points, you know, I think the end of Bill Watts's promotion to me signaled a lot of the end of professional wrestling, at least the way that we knew it. You can definitely make a case that WCW continued up until 89 with Steamboat Flair and Funk Flair and maybe even into the early 90s. But
yeah, but you want to know something? You know what people forget about 1989? 1989 was the year of Flair Steamboat. It was the year of Flair Funk, and everyone remembers how great those friggin' matches were in the Great American Bash 1989. I saw John McAdam post in his group. That's our weekly John McAdam reference. What was the greatest pay-per-view of all time? And in his group, Great American Bash 1989 was the winner. And I was there live. It was a great fucking show. But what a lot of people forget is what a huge, huge clusterfuck WCW was for that entire year. Other than the main events, which were fantastic and carried the day in the promotion, the rest of the promotion was a complete shit show.
Yeah, and I forget what year RoboCop was brought out. Remember when they did the whole RoboCop
1990,
angle?
Yeah, April 1990, I think.
Yeah, that's, I mean, you know, could you imagine, and look, I know we're going to come off as the two old guys from the Muppet Show, whatever their names are, but
RoboCop, what the hell?
Yeah, Statler and whatever the other one's name is. But it's just ridiculous. But could you imagine a promoter? And look, I won't even take Eddie Graham. I'm obviously biased to some degree when it comes to Florida. But with Sam Munchnick, could you imagine Sam Munchnick saying, "You know, we're going to bring out RoboCop for the next show. It's going to walk down the aisle.
He's going to wrestle Harley Race.
He's going to wrestle Harley Race for the world title." And then, you know, it's like that shit never would have happened. So look, it is, everything is generational. And certainly we're now doing the whole get off my lawn kid routine. But at the same time, too, professional wrestling, it's a completely different ball game. Long-winded answer to your question, guys locking up like that, it doesn't exist. It just does not exist. And my question, would people, if there was a wrestling program that offered quote unquote true professional wrestling, what would today's audience think of that?
Yeah. So anyway, you know, because I'm an idiot, Barry, I realized at the top of our show, I neglected to offer the good folks what our match of the week was. We are in fact going back in time to 1980. It's a great year for me musically, Barry. I don't know about you. March 24th, 1980, Madison Square Garden. The first Madison Square Garden match post the historic angle, as Bruno Sammartino takes on Larry Zbyszko. We're going to be talking about that match in a little bit, but I neglected to mention it at the top of the show, so I apologize for that. But before we get there, Barry, I do want to mention that it has been a very tough week. for us here in Breaking KFA with Bowdrin and Barry, as we lost two guys that were just huge, hugely important to the history of our business. I'll start off with Jim Crockett Jr. Jim Crockett Jr. for years was the lone holdover, the guy that held out as long as he could against the invasion of Vince McMahon Jr. and the national breakout of the WWF at the time. You know, Jim Crockett Jr. had, I think he took over the company from his father, I want to say mid-70s, give or take a year or two. Mid-Atlantic, I know my friend John Hitchcock and Bruce Mitchell will say that Mid-Atlantic was the best territory in the country at that point. Some Florida people might disagree, but it was there was some great stuff going on there into the 80s. And then when he started to develop the idea of going national, after he saw what crazy shit happened with Starrcade 83, with stuff like Piper and Valentine, Flair and Race, Steamboat and Youngblood versus Slaughter and Carnotal in April was the original impetus to give him that move to go to Starrcade, which then, of course, created the idea for a national breakout after Vince did it. And he brought in Dusty as his booker, and they started going national. And all that was because of Jim Crockett Jr., and the handle that he had on his promotion. Unfortunately, I think it's pretty well known that he at some point really began to lose control of that as Dusty developed more and more internal power. And to quote an old line about George Allen, he was given an unlimited budget and he overspent on it. And that's kind of what Dusty did, and really was the beginning of the end for Jim Crockett Promotions, the NWA, and eventually WCW, Barry.
Yeah, I really like Jim Crockett Jr. too. It's, I never met the man, and we only saw him, occasionally on television. But there was something about him that I don't know. There was a certain respect that I had for Jim Crockett. And certainly, he was taken advantage of. There are a lot of stories out there that he was taken advantage of by Dusty Rhodes. I would have to believe that's probably accurate. But at the same time, Dusty might have gambled and might have said, hey, we're going to try this, see if it works, and it doesn't work. And one thing led to another, and Crockett wound up selling the promotion. But he was he wasn't a part of my childhood. He was a part of my young adulthood. And I really liked being able to tune in the 1980s to TBS or one of the syndicated shows that would air in South Florida on Sunday nights, Jeff, if you remember. And be able to watch those shows. And I loved it. It would, I'd wake up Sunday morning and I would usually spend the day on the beach, maybe sometimes working in a restaurant as a waiter. I wasn't a manager. Well,
manager?
No. I was a waiter at that stage.
Just wanted to check.
Yeah.
Just wanted
to check. The '90s when I made the transition, but it was late 80s, but it was one of those things. He was such a part of my life back then, because I loved wrestling. That was such a big deal. So I was really sad, and I saw photos of him when he passed. Not photos of him as he was passing, but photos of him in recent years. And he looked the same but different, because he was obviously 30 years older. But I also realized I hadn't seen Jim Crockett Jr. since he was done. Since he left professional wrestling. So I was really saddened. I think his place in history should be greater than it actually is.
Yeah. And like I said, the legacy of Mid-Atlantic wrestling, and still I can think of not only Hitch and Mitch, but so many others that look back on their childhood spent in that, that particular part of the country, in that area. And guys just like, they'll still mark out when they see a guy that wrestled, 40 years ago, and they'll go, oh my God, you were such a part of my childhood. Yep. You and I understand that with Florida, and it's definitely a territorial thing. And I completely get that. So, okay. The other loss that we suffered this week, Barry, I think was one that maybe hits you a little more personally, and myself included, because, when I first started, my family moved to Fort Lauderdale in June of 1973, and I first started tuning into Championship Wrestling from Florida, the, without question, number one heel in the state of Florida was Buddy Colt. And we lost Buddy this week. And Barry, I know you wanted to share some thoughts of your memories with Buddy also.
Yeah, that was a tough one, too. And I got a message, I guess it was Friday, and I got a message, and it was is it true that Buddy Cole is dead? And immediately I was like, what? That was the first I had heard about it. And I called somebody that would have known, and they confirmed that, yeah, Buddy had actually passed 2 days earlier. He had passed on March the 3rd, which would have been the Wednesday. And it really was tough. Buddy was 85 years old, but let there be no mistake about it, that even though Buddy had Parkinson's disease, he was, I guess, in the early stages of dementia, that he still could have knocked you out in 2 seconds. And when I say you, I'm anybody listening to this right now. Buddy was still a tough guy and a badass, but a real genuine, honest human being. And my interactions with Buddy really only go back probably to the last 5 or 6 years, personal interactions, when I met him in 2015. And we stayed in contact. I had booked him for a fan fest. I think it was the second or third one we did. I forget exactly which one Buddy was a part of. And then Buddy was going to be a part of the one that was canceled during last year's WrestleMania, when everything was canceled because of COVID. And I saw Buddy a few times, whether it was a Legends luncheon. But I'll tell you, one of the longest conversations I had with Buddy, strangely enough, was at a wrestling event at the old Fort Hesterly Armory, which was now the JCC, and it was the first wrestling show, and I believe the only one that's taken place in that building since they renovated it and it became a JCC. And it was a card put on by Jody Malenko, Jody Simon, and Buddy was there with his wife. And I was talking with somebody, and I think it was Brian Blair or Steve Kern, and Buddy walked over. And they introduced me, and I said, Buddy, you and I have met before. And he said, oh, that's right. You know, and you're the Florida guy, is how he referred to me, the guy that does all of the newspaper clippings and things like that. And we sat down at this event and probably talked for a half an hour. And Buddy was one of those guys, and I believe this to be very genuine, that he was super appreciative that people remembered him. That because, you know, his career ended, Jeff, in 1975. He was basically done. Yes, he was a referee for a stint. Yes, he was a commentator on television up until, I guess, early 87 or late 86. But at the same time, he was a guy that had really been out of the spotlight as far as being a professional wrestler. And if you asked him a question, he loved to respond to it because he was so thrilled that you remembered what he did. And to me, being able to sit there, this is always the key. It was what we talked about with Pat Patterson the night that we sat in the lobby of the hotel and Pat just told stories for like 2 hours. And to be able to sit there with Buddy and his wife, beautiful wife, by the way, and just listen to him tell me stories about Jack Briscoe and Bobby Shane for a half an hour, you know, it was everything to me. So I was really taken aback that he was gone. He, you know, people had been in contact with him 24 and 48 hours earlier, you know, and sharing memories and things like that. And Buddy is one of those guys, too, who developed this cult-like figure in the last few years, much like Rick Hunter, the Gladiator. You know, Rick Hunter, the Gladiator, spent 8 months in the state of Florida, 8 months in the state of Florida. Yet you can ask all the old timers, Greg Good, Bob Newman, Paul Udell, who their favorite wrestler was, and they'll all say the Gladiator, which really says something. Buddy Colt was another one. That Buddy Colt, I don't know how many people truly appreciated Buddy Colt when he was wrestling in his heyday, but in retrospect, in later years, he definitely took on this larger than life figure, and everybody just truly just loved the guy. He was just super, super popular. The fact that he interacted with so many people on Facebook and through social media, you know, I think also added to that. And one thing about Buddy too, Jeff, and I don't know if you knew it, but I think you did. Buddy was a massive, massive dog lover. He had several dogs. One of his dogs just died over the last couple of months, and that was Star. And I know that he was devastated by the loss of his dog, but I could post, and you know, I could post 10 photos of my kids and Buddy wouldn't say a word. And I post a photo of my dog and Buddy's the first one to comment. So he was really a good, you know, you love dogs, you're a good person, right? That's our mantra.
No, oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. So, you know, so Buddy was just a great guy. I'm devastated, you know, and I feel like, you know, we've not only lost a link to professional wrestling, especially CWF and, you know, something of that. But, you know, we've lost a decent human being as well. Somebody who truly gave a shit about important things in life. So this is a tough one for me.
All right. So as we are wont to do here on Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry, we raise an adult beverage to the memory of Jim Crockett Jr. and Buddy Colt. Both you gentlemen will be missed and remembered by longtime wrestling fans. So now, Barry, let's turn to our match of the week. As I mentioned, we are talking March 24th, 1980, Madison Square Garden. It is the first Madison Square Garden card after the big angle where Larry Z had turned on his mentor, Bruno Sammartino. And let me just say, holy crap, was the crowd in Madison Square Garden on fire that night. And that's part of what made this a really fun match to watch, in my opinion. Barry, why don't you tell the folks what you thought about the match?
Yeah, I think the story behind this match and the crowd and the love for Bruno and the hatred for Zbyszko and what he'd done truly makes this match. The match itself, let's be honest, there's nothing that is overly special about this match. I think it was booked well, I'll say that. But there's such an intensity. You can almost see it in the air. Like, literally, you can feel it. And Zbyszko, too. You know, how long had Zbyszko been a heel when this match took place, Jeff? A few weeks, a month? I don't
know. Yeah, at that, long. Yeah.
The guy was already like a fucking main event star heel at this point. How does that happen so quick? I thought that was what was really incredible about it. There are points, especially in the beginning of the match, that I thought, you know, when Bruno's got him in an arm lock for a couple of minutes on the mat, I was like, yeah, you know, she should be beating the shit out of him at this point. I thought the ending was fantastic. And if you wanted to convey that two guys hated each other, especially one guy hates the other guy, which Bruno hating Zbyszko for what he'd done, that was really successful, because Bruno at the end of that match, I thought, was unbelievable. But I did have some notes, and unfortunately the notes are in a completely different room than my palatial studios where I've left them. So I'm going to go off of memory and enjoy this, but Dick Kroll is the referee. I got to tell you, Dick Kroll, I think, was one of the best referees ever in professional wrestling. Nobody ever mentions Dick Kroll's name. Does a tremendous job.
Was that the guy that they used to always say the biggest problem with him was that he appeared to be bigger than some of the wrestlers?
I think it was, because he is big. He's a big guy. And maybe that's it. Maybe that's the issue right there. But if you watch his facial expressions and you watch the way that he works in the match, I think he's fantastic. I've always said, look, Tommy Young, love him or hate him, Tommy Young sometimes could be a little bit too much. And we've discussed that. Dick Kroll, perfect, does a great job. This match also... part of the Bruno Hair Club for Men.
Bruno with the apparent former rodent. It looks like a rodent on top of his head.
You've seen the photos of me as a kid. That was my hair because I was a kid. Imagine it on a grown adult like Bruno, a guy who's like in his 40s or 50s.
Yeah, and then when Bruno went to the afro, that was also...
It was it's tough to watch that, you know, the hairpiece tough is definitely tough to watch, but good solid match. Jeff, I have some questions. You may or may not know the answer. And Sweet Lou, if Jeff does or does not know the answer and you want to chime in, so with Zbyszko, and I don't know why I don't know this, but did Bruno legitimately train Zbyszko, or is this all just part of an angle? And I know they're both from Pittsburgh. There's a lot of physical similarities body-wise, especially during this era. They're both kind of short and stocky, you know, powerful-looking guys. Did he legitimately train him, or is this all part of a storyline? Was there legitimate heat between these two? Because after this, I don't believe they ever worked again, and I want to say I did hear that there was heat. And what happened that caused Zbyszko to leave the WWWF, I believe during this program or at least right after, and then never to return ever? Like, do you know any of that backstory at all?
I want to say that Zbyszko, I think when we had the dinner with Larry in Fort Lauderdale, that Larry said that he wanted to get in the wrestling business, and he knew where Bruno lived. Now, whether he was working us, and that was all part of what became the eventual storyline, but I do believe that Bruno played a part in his training when he was just plain old Larry Whistler. The second part of the question, I think it was just there was a decision made that, look, we got to sell this thing to the nth degree, and that's part of why they never were seen with one another, but they were just keeping the angle alive, you know. The story of Bruno of Zbyszko and why he left, you know, I've heard a few different stories, unhappy with his payoffs. Maybe the Shea Stadium payoff was part of it, but it wasn't a case, because I saw something posted recently that said, oh, this is the part where Larry said that he had left or had heat. And here he was still like working on a main event with Backlund in Philadelphia or something like that. And so I don't know whether or not his time in the WWF had just run its course, but he sort of like disappeared for a year or two before he shows up on Georgia Championship Wrestling.
Right. Right.
And that's where he became Larry Stahl, basically, because, you know, every match before he would lock up, there was always Larry Zbyszko's famous, you know, he'd fake the lockup and he'd roll out of the ring and kind of worked the crowd for about 3 or 4 minutes. And it was like a joke in the Observer that none of Larry's matches ever started when the bell rang, because, you know, he would always stall for like the first 4 or 5 minutes. And so, I don't know if I've really answered your question in any part whatsoever, but that's just that's my understanding. Lou, what do you know?
If I may just briefly interject, I know that after, Larry Zbyszko left the World Wrestling Federation, there was a period of time, I want to say 81 or 82, where Bruno was no longer commentating or involved with the WWF. And for a time, I believe he was involved with an independent promotion out of Pittsburgh or Pennsylvania. And I saw just a brief clip on YouTube of their TV. Bruno was commentating along with Sam Menaker, the longtime Indianapolis and Australia commentator, a pro wrestler going way, way back.
And foil of Bobby the Brain Heenan.
Pretty boy, Bobby Heenan, yeah, yes.
That's true, yes.
Part of that was there was an interview, like a promo with Larry. And I think Larry Zbyszko was, if I'm not mistaken, he was doing a program with David Sammartino or Bruno Jr., as he was known at the time. So that may fill in a gap or two about his time between the WWF and Georgia.
That's interesting. So there wasn't legit heat between Bruno and Larry then?
I don't believe so, though. If you listen to John Arezzi on Quick Plug, Pro Wrestling Spotlight Then and Now.
Who produces that fine program, by the way, Lou?
Well, I'm a producer, and our man Jace Mayo Nacaretto, associate, produces that.
Who?
Jace. Do you not know Jace?
No. The way you said, what's his name?
Jace Mayo Nacaretto or Sharknado. Jace. Or.
Okay. That's where you had me confused. Okay.
He goes by several names.
Is it a witness protection program or something?
Well, he lives in Winnipeg, which is kind of a form of witness protection in its own right.
Being in the witness protection program.
But so. One of John Arezzi's wrestling fan conventions in New York, I want to say the one in 1991, Bruno and Larry Zbyszko were both there. And the way John tells it was that Bruno and Larry had like really little to no interaction besides maybe a posed photo. So who knows? There may have been some heat somewhere down the line, but by the time I got to see the WWE Hall of Fame where Bruno inducted Larry, and, you know, it seemed like they were pretty tight. So,
but Larry Zbyszko's in the WWE Hall of Fame?
He is. He went in the year that I want to say was WrestleMania 31 in Santa Clara at Levi's Stadium. I went to the Hall of Fame ceremony, which was at the Shark Tank.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, Lee, Lou, that was fantastic insight.
Who?
Lee.
very, very round of applause for Lou on that solid intel he's providing here on Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdre and Barry. Appreciate it, buddy.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
You'll see a bump in pay next week. Thank you very kindly.
Yep, there'll be a little something extra next week in the paycheck and a little gift card to Outback for you. So,
ooh, yeah. Sparing no expense.
Only the best. Absolutely.
So anyway, all right. So I will post a link to this fine wrestling match between San Martino and Zbyszko. Again, check out the crowd because they are literally on fire. You know, somebody, for the life of me, I can't remember who it was, said, check out the intros when Bruno goes over to Vince at ringside and tells him to go fuck himself.
Does so, he really?
That's what the guy claimed to happen. I can't remember who it was that said that, but somebody did, and it was really funny. And I appreciate that little input. That was good stuff.
Did you ever see Bruno wrestle live?
Let me think. You know, I do not think I ever did. And of course, you know, when I was a kid, 10 or 11 years old, when I first started getting the wrestling magazines, and I was literally scooping up Wrestling Monthly, The Ring, Wrestling Review, the After magazines, anything that was out there that, here's one, Barry, Tommy Kaye's Big Book of Wrestling.
Oh, I used to love the Big Book of Wrestling. Oh,
and
yeah.
And I would get all those, and you'd look for the ones with Bruno. So of course, when I first started out, Bruno was my favorite wrestler, because I was like, holy crap, sure, this guy's the greatest one in the world. And then you see him wrestling, and you're like, I like Jack Briscoe a little bit better. And, you know, so, but I mean, he was the belt, you know, the physique that there weren't a lot of guys that had those physiques. Yeah. Bruiser and Crusher did, like you said last week or the week before, Barry, but Bruno just, he was so, photogenic with the belts. And of course the media out of New York, they did everything they could to make the guy look like $1 million. They did a great job. And, you know, but no, I do not think I ever got a chance to see him wrestle live. You know, whether would that have impacted me as a, you know, 11 or 12 year old kid? Who's to say? But no, you know, this is a fun match. Again, when I post the link, watch the crowd and the reactions of the crowd to every little thing that Bruno does. They are just, you know, and especially considering it's not like this was like 1971 or 72 and Bruno still was probably, Bruno had started to slide a little bit. Let's be honest. You know, I mean, he was. Oh, what would you say was 40 plus at this point, Bear?
He would have to be, right?
Yeah. And yeah. So, you know, he wasn't the Bruno of the 60s and stuff like that, the young powerhouse. He was an older powerhouse. He had streamlined his physique some. But, oh, my God, the crowd was just so into him. It was absolutely freaking crazy. So I'll post a link to that. So at this point, what we'd like to do is we would like to go to part two of our interview with the great Kevin Kelly. So for those of you that had submitted questions from Kevin that did not hear your questions asked and answered last week, oh boy, now is the time to tune in because we are going to be talking again to Kevin Kelly. I wanted to ask you real quick, not to go to another question for a second, but the recent announcement that came out, I think it might have come out today, that they're combining the IWGP and the Intercontinental belt. How do you think that's going to be received by the fans of New Japan?
Oh, I think people are going to either be, okay, cool, no big deal, or I think a lot of people are going to be, no, that's the Shinsuke Nakamura title.
Yeah.
And that's... And I see it. I understand that. But at the same time, Shinsuke Nakamura has been gone 6 years.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that name because our next question, well, this is what we call a smooth transition, Barry, is from our old friend Tom Hale out in Arizona, who wants to ask Kevin, with the way the WWE has handled Nakamura, has his standing with the Japanese fans taken a major hit?
I don't think so. They still hold him in reverence. If he came back tomorrow, they would be in reverence, but he's not coming back. He makes a boatload of money and he likes to surf and he has no stress. He doesn't have to be the guy. He just shows up and does his matches and goes home. So yeah, it's easy living. I don't think he's the type of guy who gets too worked up about those kinds of things. So why would he leave?
Well, I think
now, you know, again, that doesn't put him out of, you know, the top of the card in New Japan. But why in the world would he leave a good situation like he's got?
I think Kent is a good, another good example of that was a guy that, you know, they did almost nothing with him. They did nothing with him when he was working at NXT, But he gets back to Japan, and it's like he's never been gone. He's picked up, and you know, they look at him with reverence. But Kevin, I have a two-part question for you. First one, coming from our old friend Chris Spiker, who used to live in right around the Lancaster area, somewhere middle of the state. He lives in North Carolina right now, but he's got a question, and then I have a question. His is, what was your favorite Central Pennsylvania restaurant? I know that you used to live not too far from where I lived when I lived there. My question is, with you spending so much time in Japan, not recently, obviously, but over the last few years, what do you do as far as eating? You know, do you eat the Japanese food or do you search out American food, or, you know, exactly how do you handle that when you're over there for a great period of time?
Oh, well, that's a great question. So, yes, I still live in Central Pennsylvania. I live in Dillsburg, so I'm very familiar with Lancaster. And my favorite restaurant here in Central Pennsylvania is very close to where he used to live. And it's Shady Maple's Smorgasbord in Amish country.
Yep.
It is an all-you-can-eat buffet, but it's some of the best food you could ever imagine. Fried chicken and meatloaf and mashed taters and gravy and all that good stuff. And it's all fresh and it's all handmade. And they have tremendous desserts. Shoe fly pie, all sorts of things. It's wonderful. We went there just a few weeks ago. That was the one place I wanted to go to as soon as I got home. And so we went, 3 weeks ago or so. When I'm in Japan, I pretty much eat whatever. Sometimes I'll want McDonald's. And Japanese McDonald's, everybody says this, is better than American McDonald's. I think they use maybe more real meat than American McDonald's does.
Are you questioning the content of the McDonald's meat here in the United States?
Well, I've never sat with my laboratory guys and had them analyze what the consistency of a burger is, but it isn't the same. You know, when you can keep a double cheeseburger in your closet for 20 years and you basically unwrap it and it doesn't look any different. Well, I think that kind of answers that question. But
well, OK, two things here. First off, you have your own laboratory, guys. That is something we need to explore.
He is highly paid.
Yeah, like he's walking around with his own laboratory, guys. It's pretty impressive. But yeah. If you haven't tried the quarter pounder from McDonald's, they're actually making it with fresh meat, so it's not frozen, and they're calling it meat. But I got to tell you, it's a step above whatever crap McDonald's has been putting out the last 25 years.
Well, see, I would seek that out then. But then the rest of the time in Japan, you know, it depends what I'm craving that day. Sometimes I might want ramen, and you know, you just get the best ramen in the world there. If you're in different parts of the country, there's different regional fair. We were in Hiroshima for the end of the last tour, and they have okonomiyaki, which is sort of like a omelet, a dinner omelet with, you know, you can get pork or beef or shrimp, you know, seafood, whatever you want in it. And they have that. It's delicious. It's kind of like eggy noodle omelet, and it's terrific. You know, if you're in the north part of the country, the seafood is outstanding. So you go for sushi. When I'm at the airport, karagi, fried chicken, is just fantastic. Chunks of, fried chicken, rice, a cabbage salad, little miso soup. You can't go wrong with that.
So you're getting very hungry now.
Kim. Oh, starving.
There's so much good food in Japan. I know the restaurants are struggling over there, just like they are in the States. And so they're looking for business. When I was in my quarantine hotel, which wasn't really quarantine, it was just stay in the district. I couldn't leave Tsukiji, which is a part of Tokyo down by the water in between Haneda Airport and Tokyo Dome City. And that's where the fish market used to be. They just moved it to a bigger location. But you can imagine that they have still all these little shops that sell all kinds of seafood. And everybody was getting ready for their New Year's Eve celebrations, which in Japan is seafood. but I found a place that sold the most tender roast that was on skewers that they charcoal grilled right in front of you. And it was 500 yen, so about $5 a stick. And it just melted in your mouth. It was tremendous. It was fantastic. I loved it. And I said, I will stay at this hotel anytime just so I can go and have these skewers of meat again. Because if I have a choice, I'm a red meat guy over a seafood guy. I'll choose red meat anytime over seafood. It was so good. It was so good. So yeah, you can find great food everywhere. You just have to be adventurous. And yeah, you can go to the American chains, but they're never as good. Like they have Fridays right by the dome and it's always like, nah, I'll eat it if it's in a pinch. But then there's like inexpensive chain restaurants, like what's it called? The name is escaping me. Caesarea, which is like an Italian, it's their take on an Italian restaurant, but it's family dining. So big.
You go to Tokyo, you get Italian. It's
Yeah, they have everything there. They have the best Indian food. That was the very first meal that I ate in Japan in October of 2015. Carl Anderson and Tama and who else was with us? There were a couple of guys that went. But there's this Indian restaurant around the corner from Tokyo Dome. It's just amazing. So we had Indian food. Whatever you want. It's the world's plate in Japan. It's fantastic.
Guys, I got to go now because, it's over. Ozzy, let's get in the car, buddy. Yeah, I'm out.
All right. So, I mentioned before on the show, Kevin, that when I went to Japan in December of 87, that again, as you mentioned, some of the best places to eat were in, whether it was in, Nagoya or Tokyo, the bigger cities, you find those little joints where they have the meat on the skewer and they cook it right in front of you for, like you said, $5 or $10. And holy crap, that was some good eating. There's no question about that.
You go to an izakaya restaurant, which is like a bar, and the skewer is a charcoal cooked meat. You get all this cooked right in front of you and you have a highball or a beer and boy, you're all set. You don't need anything else.
Okay. Next question comes from Mark Hertwick. I always mispronounce Mark's name. Sorry, Mark. He has a two-part question. I don't know who Mark thinks he is with two questions for you. He says, during your time with the WWE, one of the most famous angles that you were involved with was the controversial Pillman's Got a Gun angle. What are your memories of that angle? And do you think that maybe it went too far at the time or crossed some kind of line?
Well, it definitely went too far and crossed some kind of line because USA Network told Vince that very same point the next day. They weren't happy at all. And it was one of those things to ask forgiveness instead of permission. So, but it was a lot of fun. I can tell you that because it was, except for my little stand-up, which we shot maybe 20 minutes, half an hour before we went on air. We just waited for it to get dark. The rest of it was live. And it was wild and chaotic and crazy. And we didn't plan a bunch of stuff out. It was just here. Okay, so we're coming back here and we've got to do this. And we're coming back now for this one. And we've got to do this. And Steve knew what he was going to do and Brian knew what he was going to do. He was so incapacitated. He just had his second surgery on his leg. But that was it. It was kind of sad because Brian was in a lot of pain and he was, but the wheels were turning, man. And Brian Pillman, for all his physical tools, we all know this, that his best tool was his mind. And he certainly was working in overtime that day. It was just great to spend time with him, spend time with Steve, and watching those guys create this whole thing was tremendous.
Gotcha. So Barry, I think that when we have Kevin back for his third visit with us, I think we have to do a portion of the show about just Brian Pillman stories.
That's a good idea. I was actually thinking breaking kayfabe with Bowdrin, Barry, and Kevin.
Well, I don't know if we can meet his contractual demands.
Well, that's a good point. That's a definite good point. So just to touch.
I need to support. You know what I mean? It's like a whole big thing.
Just to touch on what you were saying, too. So when we were asking about Pillman and going too far, and you said that the angle did go too far, obviously because USA Network felt that. Did you feel that personally? And in your opinion, if not, in your opinion, what is going too far in a wrestling angle?
Going too far is when you get your hand slapped. Now, again, it's a different day and age. So I think that we need to be, we as content producers, we need to be aware of all of that now. In 1997, it was a little easier. And it was push the envelope, push the envelope, push the envelope. Okay, you've gone too far. I always said, I would rather have talent that I have to produce back as opposed to talent I have to produce up. If I'm telling you we've got to dial it back, then that's okay. Because I can make great stuff out of somebody like that as opposed to I got to light a fire under this guy. I got to find out what motivates him because he has all the tools, but he just doesn't bring it. So that's the thing. You as, or Vince in that regard. Vince has to be the final voice. And everybody needed to bring their best work to him. Now, what the way it works is you bring it to the writers. The writers have their own spin on it. And they present your ideas in a certain way. And if Vince is mad at that writer because he sniffed or because his collar is askew or whatever, he's, you know what I mean? But Vince has his own ideas and his own wacky vision for his the stuff that he produces and his own sense of humor. Vince told us doing BOs, and this was in 1996. So again, a lot has happened and a lot has changed, but he had said, you know, I saw the funniest movie I've ever seen in my whole life last night. And everybody's like, oh, what was that, Vince? Kingpin. Kingpin was the funniest movie that he had ever seen. So that tells you a little bit about his sense of humor. And
ain't got no bull, got a, or ain't got no cows, got a bunch of bulls though.
He got Munsoned. That's right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm thinking like Vince has seen, could have seen every great comedy ever made, you know, the Marx Brothers, Some Like It Hot. I'm thinking of classic comedies that are funny, but Kingpin. All right. Kingpin. So Steve Carino loves Kingpin.
Second best bowling movie ever.
What was the best?
Well, Big Lebowski. Come on, Kevin.
Oh,
yeah, come on now.
Absolutely. Okay, let me get to the second part of Mark's question here. So the second part for Kevin that Mark Hertwick wanted to ask is, now that you're currently working for NJPW, if you were in charge, if they called you the booker, who is the one active wrestler without any restrictions that you would bring into the promotion, and how would you at least initially book that individual?
Okay, that's the unanswerable question, because the first thing I'd have to do is find out what's everybody's contract status around the world.
Well, he's saying there's no restrictions, so pretend there's no contracts.
No restrictions. Well, obviously, I would bring Cesaro in. That's a no-brainer. And I would put him in the G1, and I would let him have great matches with everybody. I'd bring FTR in. I'd have them have tag team matches. Again, I would introduce a lot of these guys because you have to introduce them. You can't assume that the Japanese audience knows who a global star is because they haven't been in Japan a lot. And you can't assume that they know who WWE is. Now, Jon Moxley, Chris Jericho, those are main event household stars, top names. But it took a little bit for Moxley to sort of get over. So if you can use a tournament, and New Japan has a lot of them, so let's use a tournament to get a certain individual or team over. So you bring Cesaro in, you let him have great matches in the G1, and then he gets a win over a champion. And then he gets a title match against that champion, and we go from there. FTR, same thing. You put those guys in World Tag League, and you let them have great matches with every team that New Japan can have. You bring and the team that I want to bring in sooner rather than later is Aussie Open. Two guys from Australia, Mark Davis and Kyle Fletcher, who wrestled the Gorillas of Destiny to a near standstill at Royal Quest a couple of years ago. G.O.D. escaped with the win, but Aussie Open proved to me and everybody that they can hang. So those are just three right off the bat. But you know, Kevin Nash, when he was in TNA, I think he was asked, well, what do they need to do? Well, they need to bring, they need to get $20 million and get John Cena. So obviously John Cena versus a Tanahashi for a Tokyo Dome. That would be, I would, that would be a mega match, right? Would The Rock be interested in coming over and doing something at a Wrestle Kingdom? I think that would be fascinating. So yeah, you could do The Rock versus Tanahashi. You could do John Cena versus Tanahashi. That would be incredible.
Who's a guy you'd like to see Okada face that he's never faced?
Randy Orton. I would love that. Randy Orton. What about a Triple H? Triple H versus Okada? Come on. Even Triple H now, you know what I mean? Who's wrestles occasionally. He and Okada would have a fantastic match. Roman Reigns versus take your pick. Oh my goodness. It'd be incredible. But you would use those guys in a supportive role to further enhance the business, further enhance New Japan's business. That would be the one thing that I would do, because then you book rematches in the US and you could draw good houses here with those guys as well. So yeah, I think that that would be I think that would be a great way to go.
So just so I can give this person his name a mention, Brian Huff also reached out and he asked pretty much the same question by bringing in three guys. So Brian, I hope we answered your question also, but I just thought of another one. On their best day, okay, when they're, from what you've seen so far, of course, on their absolute best day, when they are working like out of their mind, who will have a better match, Ibushi or Okada?
Oh.
We like to ask the tough questions here, Kelly.
Well, the good thing is there's no wrong answer.
That's true.
Okay. So if I think it depended on the scenario.
Or the opponent, maybe.
Or the opponent. So it would have to be who they would be wrestling. Ibushi and Naito bring out a magic with each other. And Sonata and Okada bring out a same level of magic. I'll put it this way. I think Okada cold can have a better match with anybody because he is more familiar with the Western style. Whereas, but Ibushi can work with anybody. I'm really trying to pin down one and I can't.
Well, you know, famously, I'll tell you while you're thinking that when Riki Choshu in the mid to late 80s was like one of the best wrestlers in the world, he famously had a match with Ric Flair that was just a complete stinkeroo, you know, and the reason was because Riki Choshu would have fantastic matches against, you know, your Jumbos, your Tenrus, your Fujinamis and all the, you know, the Japanese guys. But when he fought the Americans, his matches usually weren't as good. So sometimes that just happens.
There's a different style, too, that when Americans go over, that I think that they would, that a lot of times they have to figure things out. New Japan is slower. And you really got to take your time. So you can't just be fighting back the whole time. You can't just be grabbing a hold of Tanahashi and pulling him up. Leave him alone. Let him sell for you. Let him stay there. And that's different than the United States, which is mostly television, which is mostly go, 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 action, action, action. Because if you're not up and you're not moving, Vince is screaming at the referee and the referee's telling you, get up, get moving. So it takes a little bit of adjustment, and we see that with everybody. Every name that I said that would that would come over cold would have an adjustment period. That's why you need a tournament. It would take them one or two matches to figure it out. And, you know, Moxley took him, it took him about 10 minutes to figure it out, but he was also able to do his style of match. And, you know, they made sure they put him in with the right kind, like what he and Suzuki were able to do a year ago, February. Was just remarkable. That was a match that was tailor-made for both guys. So, but I would love to see any of those guys wrestle a Nagata. Just from a purist standpoint, because I'm a huge Yuji Nagata fan. I want to see Nagata in against a Cesaro. I want to see Nagata against a Randy Orton or an Edge. Oh my God, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah, Jeff, that was an excellent question too. And I
tried.
As well, it didn't come from you, but you could take all the credit for it. But yeah, that'd be all right. But it was, you know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of the question that we discussed 2 or 3 weeks back, which was the better Hart brother? Was it Brett or Owen? And there, as Kevin was saying, there really is no right or wrong answer. But in my head, I'm going, I think Okada's more of a Bret Hart. And Ibushi may be more of an Owen Hart. I do think that Ibushi might be a little more spectacular in the long run, but the way that Okada tells the story when he wrestles, I think, is second to none. So I really did enjoy that. We do have another question, Jeff. This one coming from our old friend in Northern California, Roy Lusher. Kevin, have you ever met Roy Lusher?
I have. Where did I meet Roy? I'm in Japan.
He gets around. He loves cats and action figures. So there's a video on
Roy likes cats.
Have you seen the video on YouTube where he's reviewing action figures? And I think Roy must have about 30 cats living with him in the house.
Mendes.
Yeah. I like dogs. Roy's into cats. But anyways, Roy's question, and I'm going to have to clean this one up as well.
Put it this way. Can we all agree that if you have more than five, you're mentally unstable?
I'll just say my ex-wife has five cats and I'll leave it at that.
I agree. Yeah. So
I love it. At some point it's like, all right, what are you doing?
Yeah, you've got five cats, exactly. But I make a lot of jokes that at some point I'm going to move down to Florida, retire, get a big lot and probably have like 30 dogs because I love dogs that much, which would make me almost equally as insane as Roy, almost.
You can't have all those dogs in Florida outside all the time.
No,
the heat and the fire ants, you got to bring them in the house.
Yeah, the bufo toads, those psychedelic bufo toads and everything else. You would have to bring him in the house. And when I say 30, honestly, I probably mean like 3 or 4, which would be like 30. But question from Roy. And Roy, I'm going to have to clean this one up and figure it out. But what he's saying is, and he says that you may not know the answer, but he's going to ask anyways, why does he think the New Japan streaming service doesn't have a lot of older content on it? And I would have to agree as well, only because as we're talking about Billy Robinson earlier, there was a period, I don't remember if I saw it on the streaming service or it was on one of those special DVDs that were released years ago, but there was some great older 1970s Billy Robinson stuff from New Japan. Do you know the answer to this, or is this not something that, you know, you're privy to?
I may not be exactly 100% right, but what I believe to be the case is that some of it was shot by other production companies, other television outlets, and therefore TVSI, which is the parent of the New Japan World, that they don't own it. So there's some footage that they don't own and therefore don't have access to, like any of the stuff that happened with Brock Lesnar. I don't think that that's on the world site. And there's a lot of stuff in the mid 2000s that doesn't live anymore. Big shows, yes, but Some of the other stuff, no. And I would think that it would, it's a matter of who owns the footage.
Okay, so our last question from our listeners, this is from Michael Herrick. And it's a pretty interesting question, and I was going to address my own answer to this, and I hope you've had a chance to see it. He asked, first of all, what is the match out there? And he references Flair Funk, I Quit at the Clash, that really hooked you as a fan on an emotional level and just showed you that how different wrestling can be when it's done just absolutely right.
Well, that match, of course, would be one going back to our question earlier. Would I have loved to have called live? That match is one that I go back and I rewatch from time to time to time and always just love it. I watched it live and is one of my all-time favorites. I will be total honesty. I was never a big fan of the wrestling. The wrestling was the gateway to the angle. And that was where my interest peaked. Okay. So once the bell rang and the match was over against Rocky King, and then the interview would, you know, would begin, that would be where, okay, now something's going to happen. Angle alert, all right? And you could feel that coming. So I always looked at what drove business. Isn't that interesting? Like I never, so I was emotionally connected to wrestling, but I always looked at it in terms of like Gordon at his best. Was best when, yeah, when he's breaking down a hold and he's explaining the nuances of the armbar. I get that part. But when he's pouring his heart out, as Mr. Florida has gotten his eye burned by Sir Oliver Humperdinck, you know, or El Santo removing the hood and it's the assassin. Are you kidding me? That's what hooked me. That's what got me. That's what would make my pulse beat so hard that my mom was like, do I need to turn this off? No, leave me alone. Tommy Rich's knee is bad, and Ole Anderson just lured him to get up the ring steps and attacked him. You know, that's where I was hooked with wrestling and continue to be this day. The attack, the angle, the unknown, the shock, you know, the shocking turn. All of those things. That's what gets me the best. But when you study other wrestling and when you see other styles, you know, when you, because I watched, you know, first times getting to see Rey Mysterio and Juventud Guerrero. Those guys were, I had never seen anything like this before. I didn't have a lot of exposure to AAA, to Mexico. My view of Mexican wrestling when I was a kid was Mil Máscaras. That's kind of like you know what you know. I always saw the differences because I got Memphis. I got UWF, you know, Barry, we lived in Florida. So we had, you know, the best of all worlds.
Yep.
It was fantastic. We got to see
the Russians burying Bill Watts under that Russian flag.
Those bastards. The you know, Terry Gordy coming back with the Asiatic spike. All the things with, you know, wrestling too and Magnum TA. Yeah, come on. That's what I was there for. And now I just go back and I watch a lot of old interviews. The term 1980, I've watched 1,000 times. I quoted it verbatim to Cody Rhodes on the shuttle bus one time and going between terminals of the airport. So yeah, that's my mark out stuff. That's what I live for. And instead of being able to recall spot for spot what happened in a match, I can recall moment by moment what I was feeling as this big angle went down.
Well, let me ask you, I have two matches and I'll reference Japanese matches. And you may have seen the second one. I don't know if you've seen the first one. The first one that really just made my head explode was, I want to say, it was either December or January, 86, 87. It was Riki Choshu and Yatsu when they were probably the best tag team in the world against Jumbo and Genichiro Tenryu. And it's where Saru and Tenryu were sort of playing subtle heels. Choshu has the rib taped and grabs the house mic and basically says, my ribs are hurting. If you can't beat me tonight, you'll never beat me. Have you ever seen that match?
I have not.
Yeah, that's one.
Seek it out.
Yeah, no, it's definitely worth it. And the New Japan match that really caught me emotionally, because, you know, when Antonio Inoki was still in charge and there was such a an undercurrent, underlying theme that some of the young guys thought that there was like this glass ceiling that they were never going to get through. And you had in August of 1988, Summer Night Fever, you had the New versus Now. Did you ever see that? It was a 10-man elimination tag match.
Oh, yeah. They went back to that occasionally because the first one got over so good.
Yeah.
And with the guys from the guys that had come back and you had the whole invasion.
Yeah.
They did. I thought they did invasions really well. And of course they went back to it 'cause it worked.
Yeah. And that was the thing that I love, and something that Barry and I talk about so often on the show, is the way the crowd became part of the match, because they were so viscerally into it. And because, you know, the Japanese fans are smarter. And I say that, I don't mean like, you know, they read the Observer smart. I mean, they're so much that they read up the newspapers and the magazines. So they know all the storylines so well. And so they knew what the storyline was with guys like Fujinami and Choshu and Maeda and all the young, you know, the guys who were slightly younger than Inoki, wanting to take Inoki down. And so whenever there was a close pinfall, I mean to tell you, the place just erupted with the crowd just losing their mind. And that's something that when you have the crowd that wrapped around your fingers, oh my God, Kevin, that just makes the match so great.
Well, yeah. And you go back and you watch Hogan versus Inoki when Hogan KO'd him, you know, with the knocked him off the apron and won by count out. And they're, you know, that was like, and just a hush that fell over the crowd, and then the heat and all the different elements that came in, and Hogan not knowing and blah, 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 blah. So yeah, it's those types of moments and those types of things stay with you forever. And I can, as I go back in world, and I really focus on, I focus on the modern guys, because if I'm watching older stuff, I need Chris Charlton with me, so he can explain to me what's going on when this is taking place. You know, why is this match so culturally significant? Why did this grab the people so much? And it's the parts that you don't see. You don't see the build. You just see the final product. So how did we get here? What were the angles that set this up? What was said in the press that built this up so much? And then Chris can tell me, well, this happened, then this happened, et cetera, et cetera. And so then I understand it. If you drop somebody in to, hey, here's this great match. It's my all-time favorite match. It's Funk Flair 89. They're going to be like, why are these two older guys fighting? What does it mean? What, how did we get here? Well, you got to show the, you know, the pile driver on the table, and you got to show all these different things. And, you know, then they understand it. So that's my only lack in that regard, is I can dig the false finishes, but why? Was it just because this crowd was so hot? Was this the hometown favorite? What was going on? Why did this match get over so well? So you got to know the whole backstory.
So I got to give you a little trivia. I've thrown this at Barry before, so I'm going to see if you know this, Kevin. When they did the angle, Flair hits the table and the pile driver, the very first appearance by Terry Funk in center stage to do his first match for WCW, and he does a squash match against a young guy making his debut. Do you remember who Terry Funk wrestled?
I don't, but I'm going to say, was it the match he did with Eddie Guerrero?
Yes. Round of applause for you remembering that Eddie Guerrero, a very young Eddie Guerrero, was Terry Funk's first opponent. So points to you. So Kevin, hey man, I want to tell you how much fun we've had doing this. You're always a great guest, and we went a little bit long. I hope we didn't take advantage of your time, and we certainly hope that you'll come back, if nothing else, to tell us Brian Pillman stories.
Yeah, we've got to do this more often, just to make, you know, we should do cooking with Barry and Kevin. We got to do.
I love it.
You know, breaking down the Booker with, you know, with me and Jeff. We can go in all, lots of spinoffs, more work for Lou. This is what we need. You know,
that's what Lou wants, really, is more work.
Yeah. We just need him to do more work, because God knows he doesn't have enough producing 15 shows a week.
He's dealing with fan mail and, you know, the women reaching out to him. It's not easy being Lou, and, you know, especially his wife just doesn't understand that, needless to say.
Listen, Mrs. Liu, I'm sure, fell victim to the deep dulcet tones, right?
Oh, I could only imagine.
She can't argue with the fact that women just swoon at his feet the minute he opens up his mic. Because that's just it right there.
Let's just check. Lou, can you join us real quick, buddy?
Well,
is that true? Did Mrs. Kippelman swoon when she first heard your voice?
I don't know if she swooned per se, but she understands why people might appreciate my tonal qualities, but be prepared. She will cut a bitch.
That's right.
Stay the hell away from Lou.
She's the boss. That's amazing. You know, that's what I say about my wife. You know, my wife is the booker. So I just go with whatever that was what Harley Race and I had in common. You know, we talked about that, was that his wife was the booker. And I have the same relationship. My wife and I have been together. We dated a little bit because we both went to the same high school in Stewart. And we dated a little bit. And then I went away to college and she went to Pennsylvania with her family and was doing her thing with college and whatever. And then we both wound up back in Stewart afterward. And that was when we reconnected. So we've been together as a couple as long as I've been in wrestling, because our first redate, as I refer to it, was my first day of taping with the IWF on June 14th, 1991. So we've been together ever since. And as long as I've been in the wrestling business, she's been with me. So I lean on her for like, what do you think? Is this a good idea? And she just trusts her gut and knows the business, hates the business, but knows the business. And, you know, a lot of times can provide good guidance to me because I'm like, oh, everybody's nice and great. No, they're not. And people suck.
Yeah.
So.
Well, listen, Kevin, once again, on behalf of Barry and Lou and myself, thank you so much for joining us. And that's some great, great stuff, not only about New Japan, but about the WWE and your wife and all that kind of stuff. We really appreciate it, buddy.
My pleasure. Thanks to all the fans for all the great questions as well.
Okay. Thanks, man.
Thanks, Kevin.
Barry, always a good time talking to Kevin, officially a friend of the podcast.
I don't want to go on record and say this, but he just might be my favorite guest, Jeff. There is something so natural.
Calling
so
Bob Roop to tell him that.
Yeah, which would be good. And if somebody passes away, tell him that, because that's all my communication with Bob at this point is, hey, Bob, I hate to be the bearer of bad news. Yes. And then Bob says to me, okay, who died this time? And then I tell him and he goes, you know, you only call or text me if somebody's died. So, yes, at least do this and let Bob know he's my second favorite guest at this point.
Yes, absolutely. So, okay, Barry, now it's time. Oh, it's that part of the show that some people love and a few people a little bit uncomfortable with. So for the purpose of this episode, this is for you, Robert Pascoe. It's F Barry or kick to the curb. Barry, check your phone. I sent you three lovely photos.
You did. I don't think Robert Pascoe even listens to Breaking Kayfabe. Mark Russ does, and he was another one that mentioned that. Look, we didn't invent F, Mary, kill, first off. And in reality, we don't want to kill anybody. So I like that kick to the curb, which makes a lot more sense. So I'm looking at all three photos. I got to tell you, I'm not 100% sure. Is that
the first one? Jacqueline Bisette, beautiful as always. The second one, Cheryl Teagues, and holy crap, does she look good in this photo?
Yep.
And the third one, as posted today, holy crap, Dolly Parton. They're out there and they're glorious. I'm just going to say that. And this is a horrible thing for me to say on National Woman's Day, but go ahead. That's what do you think?
Yeah, so this is actually an easier one than usual for me. Really? Yeah, I am going to look. I have nothing against her. I'm going to kick Dolly Parton to the curb.
Controversial opinion.
Very controversial. Let me say, as a human being, she is right up there with the best of the best. This is a class person. When all these fires occurred in the Smoky Mountains 3 years ago, 4 years ago, I forget what the time frame was, she donated a lot of money, a lot of resources to helping get this area better. But if there's a social cause out there, Dolly Parton is usually right at the forefront of it. She's a really tremendous human being, but I've never been attracted to her. Yes, I the breasts are huge, they're beautiful, etc. But for whatever reason, I don't know. I've just never looked at Dolly like that. I got to tell you though, Jacqueline Bisette, Jeff, as I look at that photo, and I've never seen that photo of her. She's got to be young in this photo as well. This this is at a different level, I think, when it comes to beauty. Cheryl Teague's always gorgeous, great body. She's number one, Jeff, in my opinion.
not just in the photo, but in your opinion.
Well, yeah, okay, maybe it's the photo. Subliminally, she's got a big number one on her chest, and that's what's making me think. I'm going to kick Dolly Parton to the curb. I am going to, and of course, this is all in my dreams, I'm going to F Cheryl Teague's, but I would marry Jacqueline Bisset. Because I got to tell you, I just developed in the last 5 minutes since you sent this photo, the biggest crush on her. This is.
Would you say currently, Barry, since you are now in the new palatial mansion, you're kind of living on your own there, that you have a growing appreciation for Jacqueline at this point?
Not quite as quickly.
You're in your mid-50s now. You know?
Yes, exactly. Things aren't exactly, but yes, that is a growing appreciation. And that is that wherever you found, I mean, look, I've seen, if you were going to pull out a photo, logic would dictate you're pulling out a photo from the deep, right? Like that's the wet t-shirt in the deep photo.
Yes. And by the way, for those of you that have never seen the movie, The Deep with Jacqueline Bisset, Robert Shaw, and Nick Nolte, go find it somewhere now just for the scene where she comes up out of the water onto the boat with a wet t-shirt, and they're real and they are spectacular. That's all I'm going to say.
They really are. And actually, there's a wrestling connection in The Deep. Earl Maynard.
That's right. Yes.
Right. Plays a bad guy. Earl Maynard, who really wasn't a national star. I think he did work in the old WWF. But he was big in California. He was like Los Angeles and San Francisco.
Has a great fight in the movie with Robert Tessier.
Yeah, Robert Tessier.
Great character. Yeah.
Absolutely. And Earl Maynard, too, one of those guys that had a million-dollar physique before it became popular. This guy was in shape. I mean, just ripped and shredded. But, this is an astounding photo of Jacqueline Bisset that you sent to me. She looks very, I mean, maybe the youngest I've ever seen her. What a beautiful, beautiful woman. So it's easy for me.
Yeah. I am actually going to disagree with you.
What?
Yeah. Oh, I know. It's I am going to say that I'm going to marry Dolly.
Wow.
You know what? Yeah, I'm going to marry her so I can enjoy those things on a fairly regular basis.
It's a good cook, Jeff. Good.
Yes. Cook. Yes. Yeah. She's from Pigeon Forge. Right. I'm just going to say that I'm going to F the hell out of Jackie Bisset, and I'm going to kick to the curb Cheryl Teagues, which is pretty amazing because she looks pretty damn good in this photo, I'm going to say. So here on National Woman's Day. Thank you. That's a smooth segue.
Oh, yeah.
FMK competition. Yes. And so I feel very ashamed right now. That's all I'm going to say. So, but let's talk about a woman that both of us have a lot of respect for that is not part of our game. And that is our friend Rick Lunnon's sister, Crystal Kelly. Crystal, this message is for you. Girl, I hear you kick the shit out of that cancer. Round of applause from the folks at Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. I know Rick's proud of you. Everyone here in our group is proud of you. Well done, sister. Barry?
Yeah, absolutely, too. And look, Rick is a great guy. He's got a great sense of humor. Had a birthday a couple of days ago. Had a little surf and turf for his birthday. So he's got to get a lot of respect from me for that, obviously. But, I love it. I love the fact that somebody who's not in our group, which would be Rick's sister, Crystal. But, you know, for Rick, he reaches out and asks for support. You know, can we support? Because, you know, he obviously loves his sister and she's facing a very tough battle. So when he came forth the other day, gave us the great news. I just thought that was just fantastic. And again, let me thank everybody that's reached out to me. I even woke up today to messages 2 weeks later and 3 weeks later. I'm doing great, Jeff. When I said I was doing great and I'm amicable and my wife and our separation was amicable, I truly meant it. It wasn't like a defense mechanism or some sort of posturing. It's legit. So I appreciate the concern, but I'm doing great. But this is great. You know, again, Jeff, you went through a battle and, it's the fear of losing somebody that you love and that you care about has got to be just truly devastating under that regard. So I just, I was thrilled to get that news as well.
So as we're heading for the turn and we're leading the horses towards the finish line, couple more questions I want to bring up to Mr. Rose. Barry, I was thinking about this one the other day. This is hopefully not a very long-winded answer, But you know,
oh, it's going to be long winded. Just
not that Barry's ever known for being long winded, of course.
Grab a beer, Jeff. Yes.
But I thought to myself, Barry, let's say it's 1989, okay, or thereabouts. I guess it may have happened in late 88. And Jimmy Crockett sells the NWA and all the promotion to Ted Turner. Ted Turner knows he's going to work, or he's going to war, excuse me, with Vince Jr., and he has the financial wherewithal to do so. And instead of being an absentee boss, he is, by God, going to pay attention and not let those corporate suits ruin his promotion. So he says, who do I have to hire to make this promotion competitive with Vince Jr. and the WWF? Who am I going to hire? Am I going to hire Larry Matizak? No. Am I going to hire Jim Herd? Fuck no. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to place a phone call up to Connecticut, and I'm going to hire to run WCW Pat Patterson. Barry, how do things shape up differently, the same? Does that push the needle either way?
It does. So it is, it's going to change dramatically the product that you're seeing. So you're going to get less, you know, the WWE became an offshoot essentially of the WWWF, which, you know, natural, it was a different style of wrestling. Pat Patterson, in my opinion, given carte blanche to run something, is going to give you professional wrestling the way that you liked it, Jeff. He's going to give, if you've ever seen old San Francisco, it was a fantastic territory. That was what I consider real professional wrestling. Very similar to Florida in a lot of ways, which is why Patterson fit in great when he was down in Florida. I think from a fan aspect of being able to watch, it is going to make the wrestling just fantastic. What I question is Pat's business acumen. I don't know, you know, I don't know if he's capable of doing it from a financial standpoint. That's where, but I think if you're talking strictly wrestling,
well, product, let me, and that's sure. A very fair point. Let me just say, I think you're absolutely right. Creatively, I think Pat would have made it a very, very interesting product. But let's just say this. Let's say that Ted Turner, besides reaching out to Pat Patterson for creative, for the business and economic side of it, decides to reach back into the past a few years and bring Jim Barnett back to Atlanta. And Jim Barnett is going to run the business side of it while Patterson runs the creative side of it. How does that impact it?
That impacts, and Jeff, I'm not even going to make one. Imagine if Pat Patterson and Jim Barnett were wrestling, were running a wrestling company. I won't even make one joke about that because that God knows the stories that would have come out of that. But I think that would have been a fantastic idea. I think given Patterson creative control in professional wrestling and then having somebody watch the finances, which would be Jim Barnett, I think that would have been amazing.
And let's remember, the key to Jim Barnett is all the connections that he had.
Yep.
The people that he knew that ran the buildings, that had the contracts to the buildings. That's why Vince brought him up from Atlanta in the mid-80s, because he was the guy that would lock the NWA and WCW out of certain buildings and wouldn't let those guys get into the, let's just say, the better buildings. Think about Chicago. They had to run the UIC Pavilion. They couldn't get into the buildings, you know, in, you know, the better buildings in Chicago because Vince had them locked up. And it was a smart decision. You got to give him credit for it. I think it would have made, you know, obviously, Jim Herd was a complete fiasco of a president. That's pretty fair. And honestly, I think Matizak, he would have certainly done a better job because he knew the wrestling business and he knew most of the wrestlers. I don't know that I'm not sure that Larry Matizak would have had the business acumen, but if he had brought somebody in, let's remember St. Louis television was known while it was, you know, a very well run promotion. And he had watched Sam Muchnick for the better part of 20 years run the promotion. The St. Louis product was thought of as pretty dry. Yes. Is that fair, Barry?
It's very fair. And you got to remember too, St. Louis wasn't a territory. It was a city.
Yes.
That presented one live card per month and then had TV tapings. And that was basically it. And angles were few and far between. The angles didn't. And if there was an angle taking place, it was usually a challenger getting over on a world champion. And that's what they would build to. That was basically it. So I agree. I don't, you know, Larry Matisic, and he may have had a good mind, but would you give a guy, and this is not a knock on Larry Matisic, who is universally loved, please don't misinterpret that, but would you give the reins of a multi-million dollar, if not billion dollar company to a guy that was running a territory that consisted of one city?
Well, and let's be honest, what he was doing was, besides the one card per month, he was running 1 hour of TV per month. And even that 1 hour wasn't super creative, you know? So now you give him all these extra, you know, hours of television that he's got to come up with and have ideas for. That's why I think someone like Patterson, who had sat around for, at this point, for close to 10 years, and, you know, he had helped the production on the WWF. You know, he had certainly been there behind the scenes. He had an idea how to run a national company. Was he running the national company? No, of course not. It was Vince doing it. But, you know, he helped Vince put together so many ideas and, you know, was so creative in helping Vince come up with, you know, concepts like the Royal Rumble. And he would help him, you know, book the different WrestleManias. He knew how to book a big show. And I think that would have been something that would have definitely assisted and helped and would have made WCW a far, far more interesting product. Okay, so, Barry, one last thing I want to talk about. I kind of debated back and forth because I don't want to turn this into something really huge. And that's our ongoing movie tournament. And I'm having, Barry, I can't even tell you how much fun I'm having with this and watching the results. And you know, I have to be honest with you, just yesterday we had, what was it that won? It was, it was Elf. It was A Fish Called Wanda. And do you remember what the winning, I can't remember what the one that won was now, the movie that won. But anyway, you know, usually when I pick the things out, I go, oh, this one's going to win. This is going to come in second place. And the fact that A Fish Called Wanda had so much support really surprised me. And that Elf finished in third place really kind of surprised me also, because I had this, you know, standings kind of out of order there. And so I like when I'm surprised by that, you know?
Yeah. And I like, I forget what the movie that won, you're right. And I actually voted for that. I've always, with Elf, I've always been somewhere in the middle with Elf. I'm a Will Ferrell. I'm kind of in the middle with Will Ferrell. I think A Fish Called Wanda is a fantastic movie. So to see the diversity in the group as far as what the choices are, I think that's fantastic.
Yeah. And so what I wanted to get to was the discussion on Woody Allen. Okay.
Oh, all right.
As I've said, I am not asking anyone, if you vote, hit the like button or you vote for whatever Woody Allen movie's up, I'm not asking you to sit there and say, oh, by voting this way, I find that Woody Allen is credible and I believe him more than I believe Mia Farrow. No, just vote if you think the movie's stinking funny. If you haven't seen the movie, well, then don't vote for it. If you saw the movie and you didn't like it, don't vote for it. But if you saw the movie and you think it's funny, don't be so friggin' guilt-ridden that you can't click for the Woody Allen movie. Good Lord, people, come on. And, you know, I'm thinking maybe there might be one more Woody Allen movie left that I haven't put up in the tournament yet. It's the blind draw, people. But, you know, it's these people that are just like, I could never, ever in my right mind and good conscience vote for a Woody Allen. Come on, get over yourself, people. You know, as someone pointed out, you know, you're the people that go and buy, you know, I was having a friendly discussion with Howard Baum. And I said, well, you know, Howard, you're a big Led Zeppelin fan. Let's just say Jimmy Page has certain allegations against him in his past that are a little on the unseemly side. And Howard very correctly pointed out, yeah, but, you know, Page had these women coming to him. He wasn't going after him.
Well,
and let me just finish. One thing. Woody Allen, the allegations against him are horrendous. If they're true, I don't know if they're true or not. He's never been in a court of law and had to appear in front of a judge or a jury to answer these charges. But they're very unseemly, but they're unproven also. And I just want to know if people think his movies are funny. That's all, Barry. Okay, now.
Well, his movies are funny. But look, I get it. His sense of humor may not be for everybody. But getting back to the Jimmy Page thing, is it we're saying that it's okay that these 13-year-old girls were throwing themselves at Jimmy Page because Jimmy Page didn't go looking for it. And at the same time, we're sure that Jimmy Page didn't go looking for it. Are we giving Jimmy Page a free pass?
Well, Howard Bauman.
Okay. I saw that comment and I was like, so, oh, wait a minute. So if a 13 or 14-year-old girl is throwing herself at you, and this is directed to Jimmy Page, obviously, wouldn't he have a conscience to say, wait a minute, you're 13 or 14 years old, you know, get the fuck out of here, or something like that. I just don't understand how he gets a pass in the sense that these young, and saying women is not correct, that these young girls were throwing themselves at him. I think he's equally as guilty as Woody Allen. Woody Allen may be more of a predator in grooming, but at the same time, look, the stories of Jimmy Page, Jeff, they're legendary.
I'll just mention that that horrible story about what was it, the mudfish?
The mudfish or the mud shark or something.
Yeah, the mud shark. Yeah, that's a pretty good story. But yeah, your point is well taken. So anyway, so I just want you folks, you know, the point that I made, and I've talked to Barry before, we talked about Tom Cruise movies. You know, Barry's not a fan of Tom Cruise. That's fine. I like the Mission Impossible movies. That doesn't mean that I think Tom Cruise is a great human being. Trust me, I've heard plenty of stories about Tom Cruise that tell me he's really friggin' kind of skeevy. But you know what? I can watch Mission Impossible and say, hey, it's a good movie. I like the movie. Absolutely. 2 hours later, I enjoyed myself watching, you know, watching his exploits as the head of the IMF force, because I was a fan of the old TV show. But, you know, that doesn't mean when the movie's over, I'm going to go out and, you know, say, woohoo, I love Tom Cruise. No, you know. Anyway, that's all I wanted to say about that.
It's the Chris Benoit philosophy as well.
Absolutely, yes.
What Chris Benoit did is absolutely, you know, there's no justification, regardless of any justification that people want to bring up with head trauma, et cetera. What occurred was absolutely horrific. That will not change the fact that prior to that, he was maybe one of the finest professional wrestlers of all time.
Yeah. So now, as we wrap up, Barry, I'm going to throw something at you. Oh. I always like to challenge you a little food action, if it's okay with you, Barry.
Oh, it's yes.
Barry, as you watch Svengoolie, and by the way, I watched the movie the other night. It was pretty funny. The thing that wouldn't die or something like that?
The thing that couldn't die.
Yeah, something like that.
The
yeah,
head. The head in the box.
You know who the head looked like? It looked like the guy. Remember the old TV show, The Ghost and Mrs. Muir?
Yeah, absolutely. That's
who the guy looked like.
Yeah, I thought. It does. You're right.
Anyway, I'm guessing in the Wayback Machine there. Our first reference to The Ghost and Mrs. Muir in the history of breaking
kayfabe. I think ever, yes.
Yes. So, Barry, you're on death row.
Okay.
Who knows why? It's time for you to choose your final meal. Barry Rose, known lover of all things pizza and all things In-N-Out. Are you going with a pizza or an In-N-Out burger? Boom! Tell the folks what your final meal would be.
It's a tough one, Jeff. And I'm going to throw a third item in there as I spin the roulette wheel.
Spin the wheel! Make the deal.
If you've never had a lobster roll, a true bursting with lobster meat and a buttered roll, it is out of this world. A lot of it's going to be dependent upon what I feel like at the time. Pizza is always going to be my absolute favorite. But there are times when I just have to have a burger. I'm craving meat. Or I got to have seafood because I don't eat seafood that often.
Do you often crave meat, Barry?
Sorry. Let me clear my throat for a minute. So, yeah, I don't know. It's a tough one. I'm going to say pizza. But, yeah, it's definitely that's definitely a tough one.
Okay, so as we wrap up,
Hold on there. Wait a minute. You're not gonna turn this question on yourself. What are you?
But I'm not on death row, Mister.
Oh, okay, I get it.
You're Mister In-N-Out and pizza and all that kind of stuff.
That's true. Yeah.
I will remind all of you that Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Sweet Lou loves when I don't forget, and I put the plug in for the old production team. So I will end the show by just saying, oh, Barry, it's time. You know what it's time for?
Oh, and you know what? I was so praying as you're wrapping up that you're going to mention what's coming next week, Jeff, because it's my favorite.
Yeah. Next week, Unsolved Mysteries. Boom! Take it home, Lou.